This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg, has written a new book that he knows will be controversial inside and outside the American Jewish community. In The Fate of Zionism, he writes, "I shall be making the case for Zionism not as a Zionist zealot or even as a critical adherent, but as a disciple of the founders of the movement. I shall look through their eyes at their vision of themselves and at the fundamental question they faced again and again. How could they make peace with the Arabs?" Arthur Hertzberg is the former president of the American Jewish Congress and the American Jewish Policy Foundation and former vice president of the World Jewish Congress. He's a professor emeritus of religion at Dartmouth and a visiting professor of humanities at NYU. He recently won a National Jewish Book Award for his memoir, A Jew in America, which was published last year. I asked him about the form of Zionism he supports.
I'm not a messianist. I do not believe that Zionism is essentially a religious movement preparing the way for the coming of the Messiah. I believe that Zionism was founded, modern Zionism, essentially by two people who didn't agree with each other, but agreed more than they were aware of. One, of course, was Theodor Herzl, who argued that the Jewish people in Europe towards the end of the 19th century was in deep trouble and growing trouble from anti-Semitism, and therefore it needed to reconcentrate itself, or at least a large part of itself, in its own home, preferably in Palestine. And Herzl argued that that reconcentration would dampen down and perhaps end anti-Semitism.
What was the other strain of Zionism?
The other strain of Zionism is associated with the name of a great writer and distinguished thinker named Asher Ginzburg, who wrote under the pen name Ahad Ha'am. He said, one of the people, Ahad Ha'am insisted that Jews in the modern era were running out of steam religiously. The intelligentsia was more and more secularized, and so there was great danger of assimilation, which was all around him. Remember, the late 19th, early 20th century is the era of vast losses to the Jewish people by younger intellectuals who go into the general culture, try to assimilate into it. And so Ahad Ha'am proposed that the Jews needed to reconcentrate their energies in their own homeland where they could encounter the questions of modernity in their own terms. They could face the future thinking it through by the light of their own tradition, not slavishly, but as modern people. The upshot is, therefore, that Zionism is, as it was conceived 100 years or so ago, modern Zionism is a secular movement to solve two problems: the problem of the Jews, of anti-Semitism, and the problem of Judaism, that is, the modernization of Judaism into the contemporary age.
You say that you oppose messianic Zionism.
Yeah.
When
right.
do you think the messianic strain of Zionism entered into the equation?
Well, after the Six-Day War, in June of 67, when the Jews suddenly possessed not a very small piece, or a relatively small piece, of the land of Israel, suddenly they were in charge of the West Bank, they were in charge of the Sinai Peninsula, they were very much the masters of the region. On the morrow of the Six-Day War, messianic dreams were re-evoked, and especially in the hearts and minds of some of the religious. Even the secular Jews, or many of them, imagined that this was a sign from heaven that a great, great change was going to happen in the situation, the destiny of the Jewish people. But I was at a meeting with David Ben-Gurion
And he was one of the people who led the war for independence in the late 40s.
And not one of the people. He was prime minister. He was regarded commonly, even by his enemies, as the George Washington of Israel. Very, very great, somewhat difficult man. Now, David Ben-Gurion got up at this meeting, and he said, in words of one syllable, unmistakably, Zionism is not about this. Zionism is not about victory. Zionism is not about messianism. Zionism is about making the Jewish people as safe as possible in a bad time, in a difficult century. And he shocked his audience, and he made me think for 2 years until I woke up one day and said, you know, the man is right.
Well, you also say that he said that unless Israel gave back all the territory that it had captured in the war, with the exception of Jerusalem, it would be heading for historic disaster.
That is what David Ben-Gurion said. I listened. It was hard listening. But I walked away from it saying, if this great man is saying this, and he knows more about it than anyone, then what's going on? And I finally came to the conclusion that he was right.
Why?
That we had to save Zionism from the messianic pretensions of some of the Zionists.
Why do you think he was right?
Well, let me quote one of his immediate successors, Levi Eshkol, the man who was in charge during the Six-Day War. Levi Eshkol used to say, let's begin at the end. Let me begin at the end. We now have Israel in control of the undivided land of Israel to this day. That therefore means that there is already in the undivided land of Israel, between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, there is a near majority of Arabs. Now, official Israeli statistics say that it's about 43, 45, 55, and that we are still about 20 years away before the Arab birth rate swamps the Jewish majority. This isn't true. It is being whispered in very knowledgeable circles that the books have been cooked a little bit, and that at this particular moment, we are maximally 7 years away from an Arab majority. Let us therefore, that is, if the land is not divided into two states, that therefore means that Israel has very few options. If we are to preserve the notion that there be a Jewish state for the Jews and a Palestinian state for the Palestinians, we must move very rapidly towards cooling down the quarrel and towards partition.
I want to get back to the idea of a religious justification for the state of Israel and for Zionism as opposed to a purely political and safety justification for it. You're a rabbi, yet you don't
absolutely.
Yet you don't think Israel should be using a religious justification for
absolutely not.
Why not?
If our justification for being there is that God sent us, then the Arab justification, the Islamic justification, is that the Quran has said that any land to which the Quran spread is inalienable. It's Dar al-Islam. That therefore means that we are in a permanent religious quarrel. It's our absolute against their absolute. If you are in a religious quarrel, you cannot compromise. The only compromises that can be made are compromises which are made in secular terms by secular politicians. I would like, if with your permission, to add a little story. Some years ago, I was debating these issues with probably the most brilliant of the Palestinian and the wisest of the Palestinian intellectuals, an old gentleman named Walid Khalidi, who now lives in retirement in Boston. The debate was at the cathedral, the National Cathedral in Washington. And Walid got up and said, I am perfectly, in a rather feline way, he said, I am perfectly prepared to believe that speaking in Hebrew, God promised the land of Israel to the Jews. But I never heard him say it in Arabic in his person as Allah. Now, so long as we're going to insist that we have a religious right to the land of Israel, then even Jimmy Carter will tell us that that isn't what his Southern Baptist teaching has taught him. The Jews have a religious right to the land of Israel, provided they turn Christian. And Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was his national security advisor and is very Catholic, will say, yes, the Jews have a religious right to the land of Israel, provided they accept Christ. Therefore, let's get out of the religious issue.
Since you obviously feel strongly that Israel and the Palestinians need a two-state solution and they need to arrive at a way of doing that quickly, mm-hmm. I'm wondering what you think of the Geneva Accord, which is the peace plan that was negotiated through unofficial channels. Do you think that that's a workable plan?
It's not workable. It's the dream of the end of days. The Geneva solution, and by the way, I'm speaking of friends of mine. Yossi Beilin is a very good friend. I don't know Abdel Rabo as well, but I've known him for years. They are eager, desperate to make peace. And so they have produced a plan which tells us what peace would look like. They have not produced a plan which sits on the militant Palestinians and makes them stop killing people. They have not produced a plan which has any hope of sitting on the militant Israelis and asking them to cut it out, to stop being rough and making war against the Palestinians. And therefore, until we get to the intermediate stages of how is all of this going to come about, we're not really there. And therefore, I argue in my book that we must first persuade the Americans, the American government, American leadership, to put enormous pressure on both the Israelis and the Palestinians to rein in their vehement and angry people. And once that is done, we can talk of a two-state solution.
What are the odds of America taking that much of an active role in negotiating a peace and then enforcing a peace? Because you're talking about America seeing to it that hardliners on the Israeli side cool off and that suicide bombing stop on the Palestinian
right.
side. You know, what are the odds of America being quite that active in a peace plan?
I think in the short run, there aren't very large odds because Bush is campaigning for the second term, and he wants to pick up some more hardline Jewish votes. But after that campaign is over, whoever wins it, and, you know, the present presumption is that Bush will, there is going to have to be a change for at least one reason. It is an open secret that there is an awful lot of atomic junk or quasi-atomic junk in or near the Holy Land. If we are to save the world from an explosion somewhere, let's say near the shore of the Mediterranean, we have to do it. Because if we, the Americans, do not do it, there will be hell to pay. And therefore, I think this is becoming ever more clearly a common danger, not only to Jews and Arabs, but to America.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg. He has a new book called The Fate of Zionism, A Secular Future for Israel and Palestine. You were, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you were a founding member of the Israeli group Peace Now.
Yeah.
How has your thinking changed about how to bring about a peace since the group was founded in, what, the late 60s?
Well, very fundamentally, contrary to most of my friends who are still in the peace process, I sometimes mock it as the peace industry, I have lost hope that Israelis and Palestinians can actually not negotiate. They can negotiate. Abdul Rabo and Yossi Beilin proved that they could negotiate the dream. But I have lost hope that they can enforce it. Since Arafat has no intention of putting the screws on Hamas and Hezbollah, etc., since Sharon's government would fall if he really seriously began to withdraw from serious settlements in the West Bank, I am no longer hopeful that Israel and the Palestinians can make a deal, not unless the Americans put major pressure on.
You are a former president of the American Jewish Congress and a former vice president of the World Jewish Congress. I think it's fair to say that you have been a longtime leader of the American, you know, mainstream Jewish leadership. Fair to say?
Mm-hmm.
How do you think the American mainstream Jewish leadership has affected the position of Israel on a peace for the future?
Well, there are two levels of American Jewish leadership right now. There are those who want to maintain their reputation in Jerusalem as regulars, and therefore they will swallow a bit or a lot and defend the existing government of Israel. And then, after they get through making the statements on one of NPR's programs or Lord knows where else, they call up somebody and they say, you know, I agree with you. Therefore, the American Jewish community is split within itself. I think it's fair to say right now that the majority want one or the other of the peace proposals. They are afraid to say that the only way to get the peace proposal is to put some pressure on both parties because they have been taught that this is a no-no. I don't believe that this is a no-no. I believe that we, as part of the Jewish people, have a responsibility to worry about the future along with the Israeli leadership. And I do not believe that all wisdom resides in the Prime Minister's office.
The Bush administration has advocated the so-called roadmap for peace, which is a process to get back on track with the peace talks. Do you think that that's a good plan? Is that something that you're behind?
Again, the question is, who is going to police the bad guys? All of these plans sound good and true and beautiful and hopeful. They fall on their faces when we ask the very pointed question, who is going to make sure that the bad guys don't have money, they don't have arms, and they keep their promises? And rather than center on the bad guys among the Palestinians, I'm going to evoke an awful lot of telephone calls to your program by centering on the bad guys among the Israelis. It is simply not true that the Israelis signed on to the roadmap on the idea that if the Palestinians behaved themselves, they would pull back from the territories. These two promises, or these two principles, are not linked. The Israelis signed on to pull back from the territories quite without reference to what the Palestinians were about to do. Remind anyone in the Jewish community of this, and the screams begin. But let them read the roadmap.
So you're saying that the Israelis haven't upheld their end of the bargain?
Neither the Palestinians nor the Israelis.
You're no longer a member of a peace group for the Middle East, but you have just joined another group, and this is called the Clergy Leadership Network. This is a group within the United States.
Ah, you noticed that.
And
yes, go ahead.
What are the goals of this group?
Essentially to suggest that American religion, and remember, I have not been only in Jewish affairs, I've been in American affairs. All my life I was very heavily involved in race in Vietnam, etc. The function of this group is being created in order to make the point that American religion is not right-wing religion. In other words, to deny the notion that when you say religion in America, you mean ultra-right versions of religion.
When President Bush refers to his faith in talking about Iraq or in talking about another, you know, a step his administration is taking, as a rabbi, how do you feel about it?
Very negatively. And may I quote him, the greatest of all the Republicans, there came to Abraham Lincoln in the middle of the Civil War a delegation of clerics who told him that God was on his side. And Abraham Lincoln responded by saying, I am much more worried as to whether I am on God's side. Let me put it this way. Mr. Bush has had, by now, innumerable prayer breakfasts. Almost without exception, the rabbis he has invited to them are Orthodox and politically right-wing. None of the people who are on the other side have, to my knowledge, ever been asked. Now, I think that George Bush has politicized religion, and the effort that I am part of is the attempt to redress the balance.
When you look to the future, I know that you think that there will be no real peace until the United States intervenes in a forceful way.
Right.
However, when you look a few years down the line, past the Sharon-Arafat generation of leaders, do you feel any more hope?
Yeah. What gives me hope is the appearance of a few people on the Palestinian side, Abderrabo, Sari Nusseibeh, who I gather, by the way, is likely to be here by Thursday, and the appearance on the Israeli side, not only of Yossi Beilon, whom we've known a long time, and he happens to be a very dear friend of mine, but, even though we disagree at the moment, but the appearance of the last four heads of Israel's Secret Service, who said jointly that what Israel is doing may be tactically useful, but is a strategic disaster. I think a new generation is beginning to show up, which is thinking outside the box. I was at the Council on Foreign Relations the other day when Abderrabo and Beilon spoke. And I was reduced to tears by Abdul Rabbo, who said, "I am here because I have lived all my life as a refugee. I don't want my children to continue with it, and certainly not my grandchildren." And I gulped. And I think it is that gulp which is the hope.
Why did you gulp? Why did that get to you?
Why did that get to me? Because I have children and grandchildren. Because I was 5 years old when I was brought to this country after running away from the kids in the Ukrainian parochial school in the town of my birth, who chased me up the block to beat me up because they had just discovered that I was a Christ killer, etc. I know what it means to be a refugee, and I don't want it to happen, not again and again, to anyone else.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg is the author of the new book, The Fate of Zionism, A Secular Future for Israel and Palestine.